dodges. I ride in this wind on my good horse. I call you my shiny black bears to the playhouse of fortune to take the bright silver and gold you have taken from somebody else.
Tuned to WEOS Geneva, WXXE Finner Syracuse, W201CD Ithaca Community Radio at 88.1 FM, or Free Radio Santa Cruz. This is Unwelcome Guests. I'm Lynn Gary. The new year is a time when many of us take stock of the present and consider the future. From around the globe, voices are rising to demand a change in the direction in the present disastrous course of human society. They're holding up a vision of an end to the domination of the people and planet by a small group bent on the accumulation of vast wealth and limitless power. Tonight, we're going to bring you a speech and discussion that suggests that this call for egalitarian social transformation is not a new trend, but is rooted in our collective past and has a spiritual as well as social dimension.
Like lightning, we soon will be riding my shiny black bears. No fat rich man's pony.
Peter Lamborn Wilson is an author and social philosopher who also writes under the name Hakeem Bey. He gave the presentation we're about to hear last month in New York City at the Libertarian Book Club, a monthly forum for the discussion of anarchist and anti-authoritarian ideas and movements that was founded in 1949. Since the mid-1980s, Lamborn Wilson has given a yearly talk around the time of the winter solstice. Tonight, he addresses the concept of spiritual anarchism. Make yourself comfortable and enjoy. You may want to get a pen to jot down some of the authors and writings he refers to.
I always have to ask somebody to remind me how many years I've been doing this. Usually Anne-Marie remembers.
I remember.
You remember?
December 1985.
Really? December 1985 was the first one of those. I think that practically makes it a...
I was
there! We should make it a national holiday. So it's called... I called it Chaos Day because the ancient Chinese used to celebrate on the winter solstice. The mythological figure, Mr. Hun Tun, from the Trung Tzu book.
Could you speak up, please?
I'll try to project my voice. I know there's a lot of people here, and I usually don't have to talk this loud, so excuse me if I start to fade out. I'll do my best. Before I started, I just wanted to mention that since the last time I've seen all you folks, I've done something. I published these five pamphlets through Autonomy Media. One of them is called Ayahuasca and Shamanism. It's about psychedelic drugs in country of Colombia. I interviewed Michael Taussig, the well-known anthropologist. Another one is called High in the Himalayas by Marilyn Stabline, which is a sort of hippie memoir of the 60s of India getting stoned with the Dalai Lama and stuff like that. Then Select Strange and Sacred Sites, The Ziggurat Guide to Western New York by Tom Metzger. That has Oneida and the Hill Cumorah and the Fox sisters who started spiritualism, all the mad and crazy things that went on in upstate New York in the 19th century. He tells you how to get to them and what there still is to see there. Then Overcoming Fitness by Robert Kochek is the best title of them all, I think. It actually says exactly what it means. It's an attack on the Human Genome Project, basically. And then Hieroglyphica by Anonymous. Guess who? Another thing I've been doing since the last time we met, the Fifth Estate, which as far as I know is the oldest continually published non-authoritarian periodical in North America. Okay? started sometime in the 60s or early 70s, is under new management, and they're no longer going to be coming out once every, you know, 2 years. They actually got four issues out this year, and I'm writing for them pretty regularly now. And in fact, I didn't expect that this article would be in print before tonight. This is the text that I meant to present to you tonight. It's actually in the current issue of Fifth Estate, which I imagine is available in St. Mark's Bookstore, although I'm not 100% sure of that. And so if you want to, you know, if you want to read some other interesting articles on the subject of spiritual anarchism, it's a special, they have a special supplement, including an article on Taoism by Max Cafard, on Buddhism by Gary Snyder, and a couple of other interesting pieces on spiritual anarchism. Okay, what is spiritual anarchism? I often feel that when I talk to, if I can say something like a traditional anarchist audience, that that I'm going to be struggling against a body of feeling, opinion, some of it informed and some not informed, which tends to lump together everything spiritual under the same aegis, in the same category as religion, as organized religion, and therefore a lot of traditional leftists in general, Marxists, anarchists, everybody who comes out of that 19th century dialectical and other types of materialism, and with good reason, of course, in the 19th century when organized religion was still very strong and yet, you know, obviously beginning to decay and crumble, had been doing so already for a few hundred years, really. And so the idea of a struggle against religion made a lot of sense. Now, I don't know. One could still argue that that's true vis-a-vis organized religions, but I think that enough water has gone under the bridge of history that we can go back and take a look at some of the lost history of anarchism itself, which is by no means devoid of connections with movements, organizations, and individuals that we might very fairly use the word spiritual to describe. Some cases even religious, in the sense that even within organized religion, there have been elements of non-authoritarian and even anarchistic thought. And if I could give you one example, Ivan Illich, who just died a few days ago, in my mind is a serious spiritual anarchist who really actually never left the Catholic Church, although he had an incredibly bad time with various popes and especially Paul VI. But he never left the Church, as far as I know, at least when I knew him, he said that he had never left the Church. And yet I think he's one of the more important anarchist thinkers of the 20th century. He's not usually included in that group because he didn't go around labeling himself an anarchist, but if you read his books, I think you'll see that they're of extreme value to the anti-authoritarian philosophical position. So, or another person who we had here in a forum years ago who just died, Harry Hay. Some people call him the founder of the American Gay Liberation Movement, and he was certainly also one of the founders of the Radical Fairies, and believe that's why we had him here.
When was he here?
Oh gosh, I don't know, a long, long time
ago. When
did
he die?
Just a few days ago. Yeah, died just a few days ago at the age of like 99 or something. Very, very well on in life. He was already quite old when we met him here. He turned on John Cage. Uh-huh, okay, there's another claim to fame. So, that's a real claim to fame. I think what I'll do is, it's not a long article. It's really only 3 pages long. So I'll read each of these sections and then make a little comment on it. It's actually really sort of in the form of notes, and I called it Topics for Research, Spiritual Anarchism, Topics for Research. It begins with a great quote from William Blake, who's talking about the poet Cowper, a rather well-known early 19th century romantic poet. Cowper came to me and said, "Oh, that I were insane always. I will never rest. Can you not make me truly insane? I will never rest till I am so. Oh, that in the bosom of God I was hid. You retain health, Mr. Blake, and yet are as mad as any of us all, over us all, mad as a refuge from unbelief, from Bacon, Newton, and Locke." Cowper, by the way, spent a lot of time in institutions. Blake would have if he had ever, if they'd ever caught him. Blake, of course, is a kind of key figure for this discourse I'm about to, try to present here. Blake, of course, a very spiritual man and at the same time a rigorous anti-authoritarian, was part of the mob that broke down Newgate Prison in the famous riot. He's a friend of Thomas Paine. According to legend, he helped Thomas Paine escape from England. If you haven't studied Blake, it would be probably the tastiest way to get into this topic. Anyway, I begin with Stone Age conservatism. As the anarchist Paul Goodman called himself, a Neolithic conservative, by which he meant that he thought that everything since the Neolithic and the emergence of the state should be swept away, and that basically made him a backward-looking thinker in some ways. So as a joke, he called himself a Neolithic conservative. I've sometimes called myself a Paleolithic reactionary. So Stone Age conservatism, tribal, roughly egalitarian, proto-shamanic. I say that because shamanic is, in fact, a term in contemporary anthropology and is not necessarily strictly applicable to the Stone Age. Hunter-gatherers and gardeners, the gift economy, etc. I think that's, if you're familiar with the sort of Fifth Estate arguments about primitivism and against civilization, then you know where I'm coming from here. Basically, without trying to make too much of a point of it, I think it's possible to say that for a million years or so, human beings lived in an essentially non-authoritarian society, and that it's really only in the last 6,000 years, since the fourth millennium, that with the emergence of the state at the end of the Neolithic and the beginning of the Middle Ages, that anywhere in the world there have been human beings who have not lived under an essentially non-authoritarian social situation. So comparing with the Stone Age to the Sumerian city-states, Sumer, the breakdown of the original unstriated human polity, the emergence of separation. I could go on about this. I've written quite a lot about it, actually, about the situation in Mesopotamia and the moment, so to speak, of the emergence, the appearance of the state in human history, which in some ways is actually also the beginning of history, because it was facilitated by the invention of writing around about the same time. And it's not until we have writing that we really have something we can call history, right? Before that, it's archaeology, anthropology, paleontology, but it's not history. So history, the state, writing, this trinity of forces emerges more or less between like 3100 BC or 3400 BC, 3100 BC. So very quick emergence, remarkably quick in terms of the long duration of human existence. Only probably really all the major stuff happened within a century, at least that's the way I envision it. So really, here we would be justified in speaking of a revolution in the sense of an overturning, because what was overturned was essentially the village peasant, the free peasant, small village, self-sufficient, non-monetary, non-hierarchical or non-separated society, which lasted up until about that time. And then because of irrigation, on the one hand, the invention of money, the invention of writing, a few key inventions like that, the emergence of the state was facilitated. It was not inevitable, in my view. There could have been a totally different human story. Nevertheless, that's what happened. That's what we're living with for the last 6,000 years. We've had civilization in every form of which, be it feudal, monarchical, so-called Republican, so-called Democratic, even so-called Communist, have all been essentially separated hierarchical states. So on the before you have tribal non-authoritarian situations, after that magical or anti-magical moment in ancient Sumeria, you have states, hierarchies, and organized religions. Before that, you have something like shamanism. In other words, you have spiritual practitioners. The historian Eliade called them specialists in ecstasy, who are the like the doctors and in many ways the intellectuals of the tribal world, who however have no inherent authority, and in fact if they fail to heal people often enough they're often killed or at least thrown out of their pretension to shamanistic office. So it's a kind of spirituality before the fact of organized religion. Call it shamanism if you like, even though that's a very loose term. Really, strictly speaking, should only be applied to Siberia. But in anthropology, it's become a very kind of catch-all term to mean any sort of a tribal medicine man or woman who is not part of an organized religion, and generally we would consider them to be preliterate or non-literate also. So we have that. We have the emergence of the state. At the same time, we have what I call the good old cause and the everlasting gospel, what Blake called Druidism. In fact, has always been the guise of our Stone Age shamanism and goddess paganism. So the everlasting gospel, this was a term that became popular in the 1640 English Civil War amongst the radical sectarians. The idea was that the written gospel, the Bible, as they had received it, was not the be-all and end-all of revelation and inspiration, that there was an everlasting gospel that belonged to the whole of human existence. And Blake and his fellow radicals at that time were very keen on the ancient Druids, whatever degree of accuracy they had interpreted ancient Druidism as essentially as a non-authoritarian or liberatory form of spirituality. So a lot of free thinkers, anti-Christians, and even out-and-out atheists would have rallied to this sort of druidical cause, this good old cause and everlasting gospel that could be Christian, it could belong inside any religion or outside any religion. And so I see these two things as the protagonist-antagonist in the great 6,000-year drama of history. That on the one hand, you have the state, the hierarchy, the separation, the ruling class, the expropriation of surplus labor, blah, blah, blah. On the other hand, you have a memory going back into the Stone Age and continuing, that's constantly reborn, constantly revived, constantly refreshed in the human community. Whether there are real links, historical links, is not so important. Always the same message is going to reemerge. Someone's going to think of it again. You know, whether they've been initiated by some other person who was initiated, who was initiated, who was initiated, and so on back to the Stone Age, is not really important. The tradition is there. It's, strictly speaking, a spiritual tradition. It's going to keep on reappearing because it's, in my view anyway, natural for human beings to want freedom. What we're involved in here is not something unnatural or contra-natural. It's natural for these ideas to reappear. The idea that there could be at least a rough egalitarianism or rough equality, the idea that you could have a society where no one was too much richer or more privileged than anybody else. These kind of ideas are always going to recur because they're natural. They belong to us as our bodies belong to us, as part of our physical and mental heritage as human beings. So, all of that versus what I call the 6,000-year Illuminati con job, state religion, and the emergence of money as the sexuality of the dead. I've talked about this in previous years, so it would take me too long to explain precisely what I mean here. Just get the feeling of it. Money is the sexuality of the dead. Benjamin Franklin said, money begets money. Money isn't alive. Money's dead. So money begets money. Well, that must be the sexuality of the dead. That's all I mean by that, really. Now, part two, Bronze Age. Now we come to the Bronze Age. Actually, there's a sort of a copper age that comes before it, the Chalcolithic. But essentially the Bronze Age, you got your basic war god paganism, Marduk, Ra in Egypt, the sun, the solar sun deity that becomes the heavenly version of the pharaoh. With the technology of metallurgy, this and the emergence of the state, the invention of writing and money, all these things come together to facilitate a temple religion, both in Mesopotamia and Egypt, in which probably the high priest, the former shaman who has now become a priest, takes over the role of the sole monarch. So the original monarchs are in fact probably priests. The Sumerian word lugal means both high priest and king. That's why we think that is the case. So the Bronze Age then, of course, leads on. Once you've bitten on the temptation of metal, you're not going to stop with copper. It's very, you know, it bends. It's pretty, but it doesn't make good sword edges. So after copper comes bronze, which is a little sharper and easier to polish, keep polished, and then finally, of course, iron. The discovery of how to manipulate iron, how to make weapons and tools out of iron. This is what puts the final kibosh on the emergence of the state. Now the state is heavily armed with weapons, with chariots, horse-driven chariots, and metal weapons. And war is no longer a matter of a few people going over the hill and stealing a few cattle and whooping it up and maybe somebody getting punched out. War is now a serious matter of enslaving entire populations and never letting them go. This makes a big difference. Primitive warfare and what I would call classical warfare are two very different things. Primitive warfare actually vociferates energies. It's centrifugal. There is no accumulation with primitive warfare. Classical warfare is exactly the opposite. It's accumulative and centripetal. And it ends up with whole populations enslaved, and it ends up with the warriors keeping the booty and making it, as you might say, the historical foundation for the emergence of capital and capitalism. So against this, the Iron Age, and then you could see this leading on quite clearly to things like the imperial paganism of Rome, in which we no longer have a charming goddess presiding over a garden in which everyone is equally a gardener. Instead, we have war gods, Zeus, Marduk, so forth and so on. The patriarchal religion of oppression and of the justification of oppression, the ideological justification of oppression. So you might say, and I'm going to actually concentrate here on Christianity because, as I say, it's the religion a great many of us grew up with, and therefore it's the one we hate most. It's the one that hurt us most badly. It's the one that we personally have the most to blame for whatever we think is wrong with us in the world. So I would like to actually, rather than go off and talk about something exotic like Taoism, where I could make a very clear argument for anarchistic principles, I actually want to, you know, attack the much more difficult and dubious subject of Christianity itself and see if even there we can't find within it, so to speak, the seed of a dialectic of liberation or something like that. So you might say that the early church appears as a kind of dialectic of within a dialectic of resistance, especially in its more radical or mystical early forms, which among which I think we should probably include Mr. Jesus and his pals themselves as radicals. You know, we know that there's a lot of argument about this, and you can have any Jesus you like. Jesus the, you know, army general to Jesus the mushroom. Yeah, you know. So why not Jesus the anarchist? It's you know, people have thought of it before. It's not an original idea with me, believe me. Think of Jesus throwing the money lenders out of the temple, right? This is a sort of paradigmatic moment.
Money changers.
Money changers, among whom, well, yeah, and lenders. The money men, throwing the money interests out of the great temple in Jerusalem. A paradigmatic moment for Christianity as the social gospel. Christianity is a form of resistance against the great beast of Revelation, the Roman Empire. I think it's clear that the great beast 666, which is referred to in the book of Revelation, really is meant to be the Roman Empire. And Christianity, therefore, is biblical Christianity should be seen, at least in part, as, or at least in some manner, should be seen as an attack or a critique of imperial religion. And we could talk about the Roman cult of the unconquered son, who was identified with the emperor, eventually was identified with Jesus, so that the emperor could identify with Jesus, so that Constantine could essentially appropriate the church and turn it to turn it actually into the ideological force of the Roman Empire. We should be used to this kind of 180 degree flip in history, when an institution makes an ideological flip and actually starts doing the opposite of what it set out to do. Actually, the late Ivan Illich was the master of this, the analysis of this situation, that he called the paradoxical counterproductivity of monopolistic institutions. A bit of a socio mouthful that means that when an institution gets a monopoly, it somehow flips 180 degrees and begins to produce the opposite of what it claimed to produce originally. So education makes you stupid, medicine makes you sick, transportation doesn't get you there, etc. These were the critiques that Illich made of modern institutions. We can see the same thing going on even in biblical times. Right away we have both the gospel of the poor. The idea of Christianity as a religion for slaves who are resisting, albeit passively. And we have, on the other hand, the incursion of Greek mysticism, Greek Neoplatonic mysticism, into early Christian circles, so that we're getting a mix here, at least in certain circles, of what we might stretch a point and call a revolutionary stance towards society. combined with a fierce, otherworldly, even rather Gnostic dualist kind of mysticism. But let me make it straight that I'm not aligning myself with anything that I'm discussing here. You know, I'm not identifying with this, and I'm not willing to stand up and defend any of these groups or tendencies or movements against the critiques that might be brought to them, with, of course, our perfect hindsight, right? Our ability to look back on history as if we were the perfect avatars of evolutionary perfection, beyond which there will never be any further philosophical or intellectual development, and judge the past as if everyone up till now has just been stupid or ill-intentioned. So all I want to do here is to try to understand myself, and maybe to help you understand that things are more complicated than that. That the past, as well as Faulkner said, not only is the past not dead, it's not even dead. And we all still live with the past in some way. It's like we live in an archaeological site under which there's layers and layers and layers, and somehow the miasmic atmospheres that drift up from those layers, maybe late at night, still influence our consciousness. Not to mention what we might actually be able to unearth, study, and read of quote-unquote real history. History as the study of what really happened. A very problematic epistemology, to be sure. I should mention the donation of Constantine, which is very, very important. It was a forged document attributed to Constantine, whereby the Roman emperor gives ultimate authority to the Pope. And so this is on the basis of this document. You probably remember from elementary school the Pope drawing the line down the globe and saying the Spanish can have all that and the Portuguese can have all that. It was on the basis of the donation of Constantine that such acts were carried out. It wasn't blown as a forgery until fairly late. I don't remember the date. But a great deal of damage was done in the name of this now forgotten document. It's conceivable that We could talk about this as the appropriation of Christianity by Rome itself, which I mentioned before, just as the Sumerian priest kings appropriated Neolithic spirituality as the suppressed content of the temple cults. What I mean by suppressed content in religion, why does religion work? Because it actually has a few tricks that, you know, that are effective. It has a few ideas about consciousness, about how to change consciousness. It has a few practices of meditation and that actually improve your health and so forth and so on. This is actual content. Where does it come from? In my view, it all comes from shamanism or from outside organized religion. It's appropriated by religion. Its origins are suppressed, and the techniques are used to lure people into the Illuminati con job that is organized religion. Human beings are not so stupid as to be taken in by an utter con that doesn't offer anything, right? And this is a perspective that we would do well to try to remember in an age where, with perfect hindsight, we know all about the imperfections and stupidities of religion. You know, there was a time when religion was the thin edge of the wedge. If you read the Gospels from the point of view of anarchism, you'll think that you're reading, you know, something about the Spanish Civil War. I mean, these were the rebels of their time. They were rebelling against what they saw as a very, very heavy, oppressive, imperial world. Their means of rebellion were not ours. Their vocabulary was not ours. Perhaps even their ideas were not ours, and yet there's some link there. We have to admit that there's some link there. And certainly Blake and the rebels of his time, or the rebels of 1640, or even the heretics of the Middle Ages, and I'll get into some of these groups later, would have certainly felt that way. Okay, I don't want to get hung up too much on any one of these points. I say that Christianity, which should originally be considered a radical Gnostic cult, kingdom of heaven within you, okay, a very radical notion indeed, now functions badly as state religion. It has severe contradictions and gives rise to schizoculture. Why? Because there is that liberatory kernel within Christianity that's constantly concreted over by one church after another. And yet still, like those, you know, mushrooms and weeds that Thoreau spoke about that would break through the sidewalk of the end of civilization and grow despite the paving of the whole world, so to speak, those seeds are still there, remain there. And every time one pops up, there's a schizophrenic reaction on the part of the church, whatever that church might be. Just as there's a schizophrenic reaction whenever any sincere believer who thinks that they're in it for the liberation suddenly realizes that that's not what it's about at all. It's about, you know, keeping the pockets of the Pope lined or whatever. So these kind of contradictions become very sharp and very tragic in the Christian context, I think. Maybe even more so than in other religions. But all religion is rooted in basic contradiction. The old Stone Age spiritual content, plastered over with Metal Age ideology of hegemonic separation. Religion constantly attempts to overcome or rectify this contradiction. I mean, there's always this eternal idea that I spoke of, this eternal rediscovery of the idea of liberation, also happens, in fact, frequently happens within religious circles. You start doing a little meditation, you start getting in touch with yourself, you know, pretty soon you're in trouble with the priests. You're in trouble with the Pope. You're being burned at the stake as a heretic. Religion constantly attempts to overcome or rectify this contradiction. But the moneylenders always return to the temple, and rectification is once again shunted off into heresy, apostasy, magical shadows, ritual crime. Heretical millennial sects talk of restoring the golden age. This dream derives from actual memories stored in myth and in gesture of Stone Age, rough egalitarian, hunting-gathering, gardening, gift economy, and shamano-pagan society. Those facts, if we can use such a strong and dubious word, those facts of the gift of shamanism, of the customs that prevent the emergence of the state and of hierarchy, are always there. They're coded in every religious code, even if they're not understood. But every once in a while, as I say, you know, somebody's heart is has the veil torn from it, and they see the truth, and suddenly the truth doesn't coincide with the kind of hierarchical bullshit that's being handed out by whatever pope is in charge. And so the next thing you know, we've got a heresy. I would say spirituality does not equal religion. Spirituality is the imaginal, creative esprit, to use a French word for which there really is no English equivalent, the imaginal, creative esprit of the social. Religion is its inverse, or its negation, its specter, as Blake called it. Blake said that everything has its emanation and its specter. It's a kind of spiritual dialectics, if you like. And in this case, religion is the specter of spirituality, a kind of negation which is the same, one and the same time an expression, or an expression which is one and the same time a negation. the alienation it's the alienation of that creativity into powers of oppression. And you know how this works. I'm sure everyone has had a friend who was a brilliant artist or writer or musician or something like that, and they were going to, you know, turn their power towards liberating the world, and then one day they got a job with the television station and they told you, don't worry, I'm going to be boring from within. Well, you know, that's how you get creativity turned into the powers of oppression. That happens over and over and over again, and hey, it has to happen, because otherwise we'd starve to death, we wouldn't have jobs. However, due to the very many complex paradoxes of dialectics, the kernel of spirituality is often found encased in shells of religion, especially the mystics. And here I could talk about, for example, Meister Eckhart or the spiritual Franciscans, who are a very, very radical group within the church, but still, for the most part, managed not to get thrown out. They were in constant trouble with the other more authoritarian monastic orders. These are the guys who really followed St. Francis. They went around barefoot. They thought that birds and flowers were their brothers and sisters. I mean, and they really did think that. They were truly spiritual radicals, and yet somehow or another, they just barely managed to hang on within the borders of the church. So you get phenomena like that also throughout history. The poison of religion often taints these heresies, especially if they gain real power. So if the heresy then suddenly becomes the orthodoxy, you'll find that it's no longer part of a dialectic of liberation, but somehow or another it's become the oppressor. 180 degree flip. Now, point five. In religious times, all talk and practice of non-authoritarianism will be expressed in religious terms, usually as heresy, schism, apostasy, magic, etc., but sometimes as reform within the church, or marginal but permitted forms of excess, such as monastic communism, for example. The only point I want to make here is that as anarchist historians, it behooves us not to be thrown off by religious vocabulary to the point where we're unable to understand what's being said. Because it's true that many of these mystics and spiritual radicals over the whole 6,000-year history of civilization have been using religious vocabulary to express their ideas. Sometimes they do it in such clever and convoluted ways that they actually get away with it. Sometimes they express it too openly and they get burnt at the stake. But one way or another, even within religion, or perhaps especially within religion, when religion is the world, right, when religion is the intellectual world, such as in the Middle Ages in Europe, then all ideas will be expressed in religious terms. And if we as anarchists just go poo-poo, it's all religion, and don't try to investigate what's actually being said, we're going to miss the fact that we actually have far more, many more ancestors than we know. That we are not, you know, we are not alone. In some 19th, 20th, 21st century bathysphere that's been dropped into the sea of history and can never, you know, and is something new. It's not new. It's just we got new vocabularies for it in the 19th century. That's really pretty much what it is. Okay. Historians of anarchism who trace it from a few Greek cynics direct to the Enlightenment with nothing in between fail to appreciate the realness of mentalité. Another nice French term, kind of like, you know, the total thinking of a society inasmuch as it's susceptible to historicization, mentalité. We fail to appreciate the realness of mentalité. Every age must experience something of freedom, even if only its dream, on pain of losing its humanity. The history of anarchism as consciousness rather than ideology lies buried in an archaeology of spiritual resistance. We need to reread the heretics. And here I've especially recommended Raoul van Egum's book on the heresy of the free spirit. He was the situationist philosopher. I believe he's still with us, is he not?
Yeah.
He wrote a very, very nice book on this totally whacked out medieval heresy, the heresy of the free spirit. Sex, free sex, crime, you know, orgies, great stuff. You'll love it. You'll love it.
What's the title of it?
I don't know what is the title. I think it's called The Heresy of the Free Spirit by Van Egum.
The Movement of the Free Spirit.
The Movement of the Free Spirit. Thank you. Okay.
Which word is spelled Van Egum for?
V-A-N-E-I-G-H-E-M. Really? No H?
No H.
Well, anyway. V-A-N. No, you'll find it. Here we come to the problem of Gnostic dualism. Extreme forms of spirituality often identify the social world with the natural world and then condemn them both. They reject the God of creation as evil and even revile the soul as the principle of life. Only spirit satisfies such extremists. Their body hatred becomes more exaggerated and severe even than that of the church, which at least condemns suicide and promises the resurrection of the body. You know what I'm talking about here? It's a historical phenomenon, Gnostic dualism. These are people who believe that the world is evil, God is evil, the God of the Old Testament is actually the devil. They were extreme social radicals in many ways. One can have a lot of sympathy for their history, their historical becoming, but I've never been able to have much sympathy for their metaphysics, which seems to me to be a nasty caricature of Christian metaphysics. As I said, at least Christianity condemns suicide and promises the resurrection of the body. Two completely irrational ideas, nevertheless, they show a certain affection for the human body that the Cathars and the Gnostic dualists have completely thrown out the window. Now, I think the problem of dualism or Gnostic dualism haunts anarchism. I think that, for example, Proudhon's hatred of God may have derived from his early reading of Gnostic dualist literature while he was typesetting it in Besançon. And so that Proudhon can be seen as a kind of secular Cathar or Gnostic dualist. And if you've read his attack on God, this could have been written by one of the great second century Gnostic bishops like Valentinus. It's extraordinary. I mean, it's extraordinary rhetoric and well worth reading. But there's something creepy about it. Marx, I think, was correct in noticing a certain creepiness in Proudhon, much as I love and admire it. And I think that this atheist materialism, in the form also in style also, for example, of Bakunin, who said if God existed, we'd have to kill him, can seem weirdly immaterial sometimes. This kind of materialism sometimes seems to be ridden by its own hobgoblins. Certain categorical imperatives, certain blind worship of science, a kind of machine over human feeling, a kind of strange asexuality. So this immaterialism, which lies paradoxically at the heart of materialism, I see it as a historian of religion, which I sometimes am when I wear that hat. I see this as a kind of Gnostic dualist taint within the whole historical movement of the social. Christian dualist body hatred occupies the secret heart of our environmental crisis. Even as post-Christians, we cannot escape the conquest of nature motif, which colors nearly all 19th, 20th century progressive thinking. And here, I'm afraid, I have to almost, you know, blame, there are almost no exceptions until the late 20th century to this. All the great progressives of the 19th century were progressives. They were for progress. They were for factories. They were for improvements in technology. Naturally, they thought that the means of production were soon going to fall ripely into their hands. And when that didn't happen, of course, the paradoxes, the inherent contradictions became tragic. And it's that tragedy that we're living now. It's that tragedy that, out of the total goodness of their hearts and their belief in the future of humanity, even the left went along with the idea of technological supremacy, of the technocratic society, willy-nilly got dragged along in it, and sometimes even waved the banners at the forefront of this movement. And I'm afraid that we have a lot to not thank them for in this respect. I know it's an embarrassing and difficult problem, because in many ways we revere these characters, Kropotkin, Bakunin, Proudhon, Thoreau. Well, there are exceptions. I was going to say, there have always been exceptions. There have always been people to stand up and speak against this, even to the anarchist and socialist leaders, gurus, and philosophers. So that we have here in America a Thoreau, for example, to look even in the 19th century at the emergence of progressive technologism as a real political problem of human consciousness. Nevertheless, we do, historically, we anarchists do have this problem, and I think we need to work on it, and this kind of research that I'm proposing into past and lost movements of consciousness might help us to overcome the negativities or the potential negativities of our own intellectual heritage. Going on to this point seven here, because we're all post-enlightenment, whether we like it or not, science poses for us the problem of teleology or teleonomics, the question of whether there is anything other than just brute chance, whether the universe has a meaning or a goal. Actually, telos is a goal, so it's perhaps not the best term. It's more a question of meaning than purpose. Does creation have a meaning, or is it meaningless? And because we are all post-enlightenment, in other words, we have all lived through the death of God, as I say, we really do believe in the death of God, then this becomes our problem. We are left with this really bare bones, frightening skeletal problem, this spook that confronts us from our entire past as human beings, as to whether the whole goddamn mess means anything or not. If it doesn't mean anything, on what basis do we have an ethics? Huh? If there's no meaning, on what basis could we possibly arrive at a morality, even if we've completely eliminated all metaphysics, dogma, and religion from the idea of morality? How can we say that there is a right way to live, a right way to be, if there is, in fact, nothing but brute accidents, nothing but... nothing but, you know, this reductionist view of the entire of material being. That, I think, is a very big problem. So that this is, and here we come up against also the spectral, to use Blake's term again, the spectral aspect of the Enlightenment. What I believe it was Adorno who called it the cruel instrumentality of reason. The way in which rationalism flattens permissible consciousness into one big two-dimensional, or even, as Marcuse said, one-dimensional map. Any manifestation of meaning would threaten the monopoly of brute accidents, or a random collision of particles, mechanistic behaviorist models of consciousness, or what Blake called Newton's night. Sir Isaac Newton, he blamed Newton, which is strange, because Newton wrote a lot about alchemy and mysticism and religion and prophecy, but he never published it. He published only the hard science, basically, and he hid that whole alchemical side of his personality.
Well, he had to be pushed into the science also.
Yeah, it's not surprising. It's not wrong of Blake to put that label on Newton. It's just that, in fact, as usual, things are far more complicated. Anyway, hence, I would say, from all this, we arrive at the contemporary plague of meaninglessness. Whether you want to embrace that meaninglessness, perhaps you do. Perhaps you're nihilists. And you see this is the way towards freedom. Okay, that's a point of view. Nevertheless, I think we have to admit that we all feel this plague. We all feel the plague-like aspects of this collapse of significance. as if there were germs lurking behind some thin scrim of hygienic daylight. We've all experienced, at least read about it in history books, we've all experienced the collapse of ethics. We have no thought for seven generations, as the Chinese say. We've lost this whole way of thinking about ourselves as futurity. We've reached a stage where we propose things like stopping forest fires by cutting down the forests. Or, as Lady Margaret Baroness Thatcher once said, there is no such thing as society. Point eight. The movement of the social on the unconscious level constituted in itself a kind of religion or anti-religion. After all, what proof exists for atheist materialism? Can you prove it? Is there a scientific experiment that proved that there's nothing but brute accident? I don't think so. At least I haven't heard about it yet. So to me, this can get just as spooky as God, really. The absence of meaning can be just as spooky as meaning, right? And as soon as you have this thought, you can see, for example, the Communist Party is the Holy Roman Empire. Moscow was the Third Rome. And, you know, it just is. It's like they've got a Pope, Pope Stalin. They've got an Inquisition. The whole thing just gets reinvented immediately, just reappears immediately, because that inner power, that inner contradiction between meaning and meaninglessness has not been addressed. Or at least that's one way to look at it. The philosophical weakness of anarchism surely lies somewhere near the fault line between meaninglessness and ethics. How can there exist a right way to live in an absurd universe? How can there be existential commitment? Is it just a leap in the dark? But why, in that case, why not simply carve out one's own share? Or rather, maybe a little bit more than one's own share? What Bush spirit is going to tell me no? And here we might reread Stirner and Nietzsche and see what they had to think about this idea. Nietzsche, of course, went mad and signed his last letter, Dionysus and the Crucified One, a god reborn, but only into a schizophrenic, speechless abyss. Possibly we need to consider the exigency of a rough morality, and perhaps even some sort of meaning, however inexpressible, or even spiritual. In other words, should we dare to consider this study, this research into spiritual anarchism, as possibly being at least one source for an emergent solution to this tragedy that we perceive, this tragedy which has led all ideology into this dustbin of history and this stinkhole of pollution, space-time pollution that we call the 21st century. Point nine. Now, with the collapse of the social in 1989 to 91, the collapse of the movement of the social, and the triumph of global capital, we shattered remnants. What could we do? Well, we could put on happy faces and say that globalism is just the new internationalism, the final stage of capital, and that soon the means of production will fall finally and ripely into the final hands of a finally enlightened global final proletariat. Or we could gloomily admit that the totality has engulfed us, that history is dead, that alienation is universal, that the last enclosures have been carried out, that the logic of technology and money combined ends with the elimination of the human, with Paul Virilio's time-space pollution, the big accident, the global accident. Or we could go on refusing to accept that dichotomy, either meaning or non-meaning. We could refuse. We could go on demanding the impossible, which has become really a slogan of anarchism in recent decades. But what would the impossible be if not a kind of spirituality? I mean, it's not physically there because it's impossible. It's perhaps not even mentally there because it's impossible. So where could it be if not in the spirit? Using that term as loosely as possible, and perhaps even in the French sense of esprit. If religion and ideology both have betrayed us, perhaps we need some sort of a new paradigm, which would be neither religion nor ideology. But every new worldview has ancestors. There's nothing new under the sun, as the prophets say. Postmodernism doesn't
necessarily mean simply sifting through the rubbish of history to construct more revolutionary commodities and attitudes. Let's say we want to try to imagine a non-authoritarian green movement based on Proudhonian anarcho-federalism and Kropotkinite mutual aid. Your basic plumb line anarchist stuff. But rooted in some form of spirituality. Where could we look for inspiration? Do we have a tradition? Now I'm just going to slough over the whole problem of whether I'm right or wrong and say, let's suppose that we're interested. We want to know more. We want to know if there really is a spiritual tradition of anarcho-something or other, of non-authoritarian mysticism, something like that. Is there a genealogy, point 10, is there such a thing as a genealogy of resistance, a golden chain of transmission, as the Sufis said, used to say, which passes on the Stone Age autonomous spirit from age to age, whether literally from breast to breast, as the Sufis say, from person to person, or through the recreation in the imaginal, at the imaginal level, amongst new generations of humans. Since we've mentioned medieval Europe, let's start there. Unfortunately, then we'll have to ignore the classical era, the Orient, ignore Taoism, Sufism, Shiite extremism, radical Kabbalah, Sabbatai Zvi and Jakob Frank, the great pseudo-messiahs of radical Judaism. We'll ignore Hinduism, especially Tantra, radical syncretists like Kabir, the Bengali terrorist party, which my own guru, my own tantric guru, had the honor to belong to, as he told me. We'll also have to ignore tribal shamanism and its whole history from the Stone Age to the present. Instead, we'll stick with Christianity, if only because most of us are brought up to consider it the enemy par excellence. So here's a list of subjects for research. I'll just tell you one or two words about each. How am I doing for time, by the way? Somebody tell me the time.
It's a quarter to nine. Okay. Explain.
Yeah, we're going all right. So Joachim de Fiore and the Spiritual Franciscans, I already mentioned them. De Fiore came up with the idea of the third age, which would be there was age of the Father, age of the Son, age of the Holy Spirit. And the Holy Spirit would be a kind of liberatory opening up beyond the hegemonies and authoritarianisms of the church. And so he was a great figure for the whole Franciscan tradition within the church, right? Even within the church, as I said, this non-authoritarian tradition manages to hold on by the skin of its teeth. Then going outside the church, we have the Free Spirit, the Beghards and the Beguines. That Vanagam and other writers have discussed. These are people who might have pretended to be within the church, actually might have worn even monastic garments, but if they were ever discovered by the church as to what they really were, absolutely. This included groups, for example, such as the Adamites, who went naked for a sign, trying to bring back the original golden age of Adam and Eve. Before the emergence of separation and hierarchy and clothes. There you have the radical wing of Renaissance Hermeticism, especially figures like Giordano Bruno, burned at the stake for heresy in 1600, or the alchemist Paracelsus, who supported the peasants' revolt in 1525 against Luther and the Lutheran princes. Paracelsus himself remained within the Catholic Church, but was far to the left of Luther. In many ways. In fact, I don't even know if it's proper to discuss Luther as leftist in any sense. But if Protestantism is to the left of Catholicism, at least in the 16th century, then Paracelsus is a Catholic who's to the left of Protestantism. The reason for this is that there was actually a third force which never went anywhere. It's called spiritualism. And characters like that you never heard of, and I never heard of myself until quite recently, like Caspar Schwenkfeld. I could other names skip my. If you want to know more about it, ask me afterwards. That was meant to be neither Protestant nor Catholic, but also was meant to be non-organized and non-hierarchical. And as we anarchists know, situations like that often tend to flow into the sand and get lost. There's always the paradox between how you need an organization to have any movement at all, and then that the fact that the organization begins to strangle the movement. This is again one of our permanent tragic paradoxes as anarchists.